540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Former National Enquirer executive David Pecker testifies in former President Trump's trial, in which he's accused of falsifying business records to influence the 2016 election. CBS's Robert Costa.
Pecker was allegedly the orchestrator, in part, of coming up with this scheme with Michael Cohen to help Trump sustain himself politically at a critical time in 2016.
The Supreme Court hears arguments on whether banning homeless people from sleeping outside is cruel and unusual punishment. Loyola Law School's Lori Levinson.
The Supreme Court today really seemed to be struggling with what to do in the case involving homeless individuals in Grant Pass and, frankly, homeless people across the nation.
Pro-Palestinian protests force remote classes at Columbia University. The NYPD's Michael Gerber.
We have a very large police presence, and our officers obviously are going to take action to prevent crime and to make arrests if there is a crime.
CBS News Brief. I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. 12 law enforcement agencies around Wisconsin are splitting almost $2 million in opioid settlement funds. Wisconsin will get more than $750 million of the National Settlement Fund through 2038. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services says some initiatives will help keep opioid addicts out of jail or treat people already in jail. North America might be in for another smoky summer. Dr. Bruce Snyder is with the Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate. He says climate change is fueling hotter and drier summers, raising the risk of wildfires.
And when that happens, people have more respiratory disease. People have chronic lung disease, tend to get sicker. So there's a lot of downstream consequences.
And insects that carry disease thrive in warmer weather. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, Civic Media News.
An unsuspecting driver at a Milwaukee barbershop.
I got an apprentice here shadowing me. I'm gonna put this hot towel on, man. About a good 3 minutes, all right?
The apprentice is Donald Driver.
So when you come here, you drive?
Yes.
Your car got seatbelts?
Yeah.
You wear them?
No.
Okay, but why not?
I don't want to.
But did you know you can get a ticket for that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna give you a ticket. Bet you wish you buckle up now.
Oh my God.
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Take it, click it. There you go.
Click it or tick it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Friday, an enormous victory for the UAW, an enormous victory for the workers at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, an enormous victory for working people across the country, for people in Tennessee, for people in the South. This could be that spark, that moment that everything ignites and workers go, yeah, we are essential. Yeah, you need us as much as we need you. Yeah, we should have better wages, better hours, better condition, better health care, better retirement, better treatment. We should have those things. And you know what? We're going to demand them because we have a way forward to do that. And I understand, for decades, you have seen the shifting, the migration of manufacturing from northern states, from union states, from high wage states to the South, and then the further South, and then the further South, and then way east. You've been seeing corporate America and corporate global going, hey, where can we get cheap exploitable labor? Where can we go to find that cheap labor? And unfortunately, here in the U.S., that has been in the South. This could be that moment where the people, the workers in the South go, you know what? We're tired of being the country's doormat. We're tired of getting the short end of the stick. We're tired of getting poor treatment, high turnover, poor wages, you know, less benefits, less health care, all of that. Tired of it. And we're going to fight to make it better. This could be that spark. And you go back through history when you've had those moments. You know, you go back to 1894 when the Pullman strike happened, which led to the fight for just general dignity for minority workers and ethnic workers who lived in a company town. And when you had an economic downturn, George Pullman, the company town owner, you know, skyrocketed rents, cut wages, basically starving his workforce so that he could maintain, you know, a good healthy profit margin. And also just basic, like I said, basic dignity. You know, the 10,000 people who were the car porters, they were all called George. Now, who knows what their real names were, but they were the 10,000 Georges. You don't even have the dignity of your own name in Pullman world. You go back to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, another moment in our history where you go, hey, this tragedy happened. This thing happened. 146 workers died, mostly women, young women, immigrants, led to incredible safety, workplace safety regulations, better labor laws, started moving us in a direction that we now take for granted. I had, you know, a listener, you know, say this could be like the Flint sit-down strike of the 30s. In 36, 37, you had these sit-down strikes, which was a pivotal moment in labor history, which led to the improvement of working conditions, and more importantly, union recognition, and then collective bargaining rights in the auto industry. And I've had that thought, you know, could this be that spark moment? Could this be that spark moment where you begin to then organize one after the other, until eventually you get to a place where you now represent all of them? And you then bring them into a master agreement to where you say, look, compete. All you car companies, go make the best widgets and whatnots. Use the labor as efficiently as you can. Do what you can, but you're not going to make your competitive advantage on the backs of the workers. You're not going to say, hey, we cut wages down to the bone so we could give you $50 off your car. That to me is where this line should be drawn. And I've been saying this for a long time. Now, understand, I come out of an industry that had, at one point had a master agreement. You know, when I was in the, you know, I'm in the LTL, less than truckload trucking industry, where, you know, when I started, it was 85% unionized. It's now down to about 10% because of the all-out assault on organized labor over the last 40 years. But it was almost 100% unionized. I mean, and those companies, they competed based on service, on quality, on all of the positives, instead of, we're gonna cheat our workers out of healthcare, we're gonna destroy their pensions, we're gonna cut their wages, we're gonna make them work longer hours, and of course no overtime. Now these are moments where we're a possibility. You could go back again through history, the March on Washington in 63, which led to the Civil Rights Act, when workers find their power. And this, from what I'm hearing, workers in Chattanooga, they're finding their power. When you have a vote, 73-27, when you have a massive victory like this, in a place that has turned down the union in the past, when you have this decisive of a victory, could lead to that spark of something new. History could look back and go, there it was. That was the moment. And you stop and you think about, again, throughout our history, there have been these sparks, these opportunities for people to go, we're going to exert our power. We're going to demand democracy in the workplace. We're going to demand economic freedom and economic justice. We're going to demand these things. Because one, it's right. It's just. It's all that. But it's what the workers earn. You know, I had said a while ago that I thought the Fight for 15 campaign, you know, was a great moment in our labor history, because it really did begin a conversation on national income inequality. It really did bring that to the forefront, and some major victories. But, you know, my problem is I've never been a fan of, hey, how do we just raise up the bottom? Because I know there's a reverberation effect upward. I'm of the mindset that every workplace should have a collective bargaining agreement. For me, this is an opportunity to highlight the fact that you can make lives better. And what these workers are going to demand will be interesting to see over the next several months as they negotiate a contract. And I got to think that they're going to negotiate in good faith, considering, and this is the other weird thing, that in Germany, they actually have a law that says, you know, you can't break the unions. You can't bash the union. Sorry, that's bad. We're not going to let you go after the unions and attack them, you know, like you're allowed to do in the U.S. We're just never going to allow you to do that. And again, I find it interesting that, you know, in this country, we're like, no, go ahead, you know, go. And it's almost like you have to. But in Germany, they've got this German act on corporate due diligence obligations in supply chains. It's a nice long, you know, in German, it's very small, but in English, a little bit longer. The UAW actually filed charges against Mercedes-Benz Group for violating that law beginning of April because of Mercedes-Benz's aggressive anti-union campaign. And I got to tell you, wouldn't it be great if we had labor legislation in this country that supported workers? Man, I wish. Quick break, right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got to tell you, it's always amazing to me when you see politicians who are running on the idea that, you know, come on down to our area and exploit our workers. This is something, you know, the South has been doing for a very long time. And it's always blowing my mind when Southern politicians run those campaigns and go, yeah, please exploit my voters. And then people vote for them. And the reason I'm saying this is I'm looking at an article over the New York Times where they quote Gerald McCormick, who had been the majority leader in the Tennessee House, a Republican House, who said, you know, if we become less competitive, why not just do it in Detroit? And this has been their argument. We're cheaper. Come exploit our workforce. Pay them less wages, less benefits. Give them worse working conditions. And employers will come. And sadly, a lot did. So I look at this victory by the UAW at the VW plant. This is a steal of Bidenism. It's a big freaking deal. And here to share some thoughts on just what a big freaking deal this is, I've asked our good friend John Russell to come talk with us. He's the owner, editor of the Holler newsletter. He also does some reporting over at More Perfect Union. His recent video on this Volkswagen campaign, over 2.5 million views in just a couple of days. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Rick. Yeah, this is a really big deal. Looking forward to talking about it.
So, I mean, you know, I knew they were going to win. I had it in my gut that, you know, all the stars are aligning. I had it in my head that, you know, you're coming off the last close one, the pandemic, the win at with the big three, the stars were aligning. I just didn't predict a 73-26. I didn't predict that at all.
Yeah, there's a no doubt about it win. And I think, you know, there's a reason for why that margin was so huge in favor of Union. Yes. People are tired of being squeezed by this economy, and not just in Detroit, in the South. You know, workers have seen what's possible everywhere else, what's possible with this new leadership at the UAW. They saw big contracts that were won up in Detroit, and they said, give us a slice of that pie. And they got it for themselves. You know, it's a long time in the making, 10 years, couple failed votes. It was really, really powerful to be down there and witnessing people bringing in their union.
I had one person email me and say the difference that they believed was because the UAW was different. You know, that there was a view of the old UAW as a little, you know, a little lazy, a little, maybe a little corrupt, if you will. And this one very much, very militant, very member driven, very active. And that was the belief. Do you put any stock in that?
Yeah, you know, I think ultimately you got to judge a union by how much power they give their members. The UAW has been, you know, these are democratically governed institutions, you know, but not always, right? So they've been turning more power to their members. That membership has led to some reforms like one member, one vote, more democracy in the union. You know, it wasn't that long ago when you had leaders of that union that pulled off a corruption scandal, ended up in jail. We got to remember, when we're looking at Sean Fain and the new leadership of this union, he was only elected 14 months ago. And a lot, as we've seen, can happen in 14 months. And I think, you know, the main thing to credit there is just trusting your membership, turning power towards your membership. With any democracy, right, it's going to be better when that power is in the hands of the people. Yeah. UAW had those reforms, and we were seeing wins from it.
And I would also argue, you know, using some resources. I know there are a lot of unions that go, oh, we're constantly under attack. We got to keep the powder dry. This is a very active union. They're spending a lot of resources. In fact, you know, I think they said, what was it, $30 million they're going to spend over the next decade to try and organize, which, you know, is a pretty good sum.
Oh, for sure. They're putting money into organizing, like you said. And I think that these wins that they're on, you know, first with the big three and those incredible contracts that a lot of people were taking inspiration from. Now with a win that nobody, you know, not a lot of people thought was possible. We're waking up to news that, you know, after 40 years, there's a union automaker now in the South. This is a testament to they made a big bet on political courage. They, you know, nobody would have blamed a leader like Sean Fain, you know, coming into the power after membership was hanging out near a record low, after a recent scandal, after a close election. If they wanted to play it safe, everybody would have, you know, understood that. But they took a big bet on political courage, on fighting for, you know, real wins to membership. And the members, you know, from my reporting experience, are looking around, seeing that things are possible, and they're winning unions in the South because of it.
And this is something I wish, you know, not to get political here, but this is something I wish the Democratic Party would figure out. You win by doing bold things. You win by getting out there and balling up your digits and getting in the fight. But, you know, you were on the ground for the last little over a week, I guess. And what was the message that you heard most often from folks? Was it about wages? Was it about conditions? Was it about dignity? Where did the hammer come down?
Yeah. And first of all, the reporting trip, I want to shout out More Perfect Union for doing their reporter and for doing that story. And my producer, Katie Nixdorf, she was really good in putting that video together. But the thing that stuck with me is and what we heard from folks on the ground there, this is about more than just money and benefits. This was about the chance to stay in one workplace, to not constantly cycle through jobs, to make the place where you are better, because you have power, you have a voice at the table, you have a say in how your company is governed. And because of that, you have a say in your local economy, how your community is. A lot of members told us, you know, one guy, he's a father, he works with his son in the plant. He's telling his son to like dig in, you want this to be the last job you're going to have, and you want to stay here and make it better. And then having that union representation, that's what it was really about to a lot of the people that we spoke with.
Now, the first election there at Volkswagen was back in 2014. How many of the people who lived through that experience in 2014 were part of this experience here a decade later? Or do you have any idea?
I don't have an idea on hard numbers there, but we did talk to several, and I can say the most powerful reactions came from them. You know, there were a couple people we talked to that were there for 12 years, you know, and they've been through multiple votes where they've come close and come up short, including ones where they thought they had it in the bag. You know, to see the reaction from them of finally prevailing, what else can you say? It's something that I won't forget for a long time. But, you know, the plant had a lot of turnover, right? And it was a different group of people who were going through this election, right? A lot of new blood came into that plant. And they are looking around and say, you know, what do we have to lose here? Let's get together. We've heard, you know, anti-union arguments in the past. Here they come trotting out the same old thing. And a lot of folks just didn't believe the arguments of the anti-union campaign anymore because they've heard it in the past. And then they went through COVID and saw how workers labeled essential were really treated. And they came out on the other side of that and said, there's nothing but room to run in front of us. Let's take a chance on the union. And they were helped out by a lot of the people who had stuck around for, you know, 12 years and watched the failures in the past.
Now, what was the most interesting story that you got from someone? I'm sure there were some responses there that were, you know, from the baseline to some pretty far out there. Anything far out there?
I think the most powerful thing is just so much of the resistance to unions, especially in the South, is just based on a fear campaign. And what it really looked like when we were talking to workers down there, people just realize that it's a paper tiger that they're afraid of. You know, there's a boy who cried wolf effect happening here because, like I said, all of these anti-union arguments have been trotted out before. Oh, they're going to close the plant. They're going to move it to Mexico or something like this. Well, no. You know, they would have built it there to begin with if that was the best business decision. Our wages have always been higher, but they chose to build the plant here. They're investing money in that plant. It's around to stay. So why don't the workers have a seat at the table, right? The biggest takeaway wasn't an individual story. It was everybody down there kind of realizing that all of the arguments against a union are just based on fear. Yeah. And they chose to reject that and win their union.
And I would argue, and maybe this is something that came up, but being the only place in the system that doesn't have representation, yeah. You know, that kind of leaves the, I guess that would leave a bad taste in my mouth. But, you know, did that come up at all?
Yeah, for sure. And that's that comes up not just with workers at the plant, but members of the community, faith leaders. We talked to, you know, a pastor in the community who brought that up on her own and said, this is the only plant in the world without worker representation. This is a German company. Their culture over there has works councils and a principle of co-determination. That's something that we don't really internalize here, but that means that, you know, from management to employee, everybody has an equal base that they're coming to, at least in on paper, in the governance of the company, right? And here is the United States plant as the only one where that principle doesn't apply. So, you know, Volkswagen workers knew that, but even members out in the community were starting to really talk about that. And, you know, when you sit back and think about it, you have to wonder why that is. I think it's powerful.
No, and that it is powerful because, you know, for me, looking at this, such an overwhelming victory means a couple of things. One, workers seriously wanted, but two, the organizers on the ground were able to get over some hurdles. You know, in the South, you've got we just hate anything from the North. That's part of it. You've got the race issue. I'm sure you've got legacy issues. There's a lot of stuff there to get past. And I think, well, apparently the organizers got around it.
I would take it, you know, my sense was, not to take away from anything that the organizers do. I mean, their job is really, really hard. They work very hard for this. But this was a member win. And you could really see that coming through in the people we interviewed. We interviewed, you know, white male Republicans, black women who were, you know, Democrats, people all across the spectrum, right? And they really carried the messaging member to member. And what, you know, one of them was telling me, it's like, we didn't have to go and convince these no voters to change their mind. They watched the anti-union campaigns. They watched those six governors come out and say that this would be against our very way of life. And it started to ring, you know, they started to say, hey, whose side are you really on here? And these members, they're all watching, you know, the union's bet on political courage pay off when people are winning big contracts at the big three. And so one of the members who was always in the yes camp was like, in these no votes, it's like the yes argument was in them all along. And all we had to do was point out, hey, this is a different era. This is a different union. We are putting up wins here, and the time's now to get our slice of the pie in the South.
So you think the six governors coming out this time had a negative impact? Because look, this isn't new. You had politicians back, you know, the senators and the governors back in 14 doing almost the same thing, only I would argue with a lot more pressure. So this time you think it went the other way?
I think so. And, you know, in my mind, it might have been the case. You know, Volkswagen in the past has used this tactic and kind of let the anti-union politicians speak their piece. And in one of the previously failed votes, they brought back a very popular manager and they made all of these promises and it lined up with what the politicians were saying. And lo and behold, the vote happens, they reject the union and all of those promises and all that stuff, that it went away.
Yeah.
And people were back to the status quo, just being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. So when they saw that happen this time again, it was the boy who cried wolf thing. Yeah. They've seen this and they recognized it for what it is.
Yeah, we saw this movie. What do you say to some of the reporting that I've seen that are diminishing this victory as well? This is the German company. They're clearly going to do, you know, Volkswagen, Mercedes first because they're a German company. Germany's got a law that, you know, could fine them or have some penalties if they, you know, hinder worker organizing. What do you say to that?
I mean, those are PR talking points that you do when you're on the run. You know, when you're being defensive, that's what you trot out to try and minimize what's going on. And that's exactly what it is. It's minimizing a huge movement. I mean, there's the phrase "when pigs fly," but it might as well be when, you know, union automakers are popping up in the South, right? This is a massive, massive turning point in the labor movement that I think, you know, people have been questioning, are we at a new moment in the labor movement? And they've been looking for evidence of that. There's been a lot of reporting throwing cold water on the fact that we might be in a new labor movement, but I think this gets rid of all of those arguments. There is a union automaker in the South, won by members, hard fought, multiple failed votes over 10 years. And there's just no denying the significance of that.
No.
And I think we'll keep watching it as other union automakers like Mercedes have their votes in a couple weeks.
No, it's a big deal because one falls, maybe the rest come along because not just them, but the parts suppliers and all the businesses that feed into this, much like we saw in the 30s. I mean, this could be that spark that reignites that reward for work. When you got to open the books and see what your labor is worth, you start going, I'd like more of it, please. So last line of questioning I've got for you, you know, May is coming up fairly quick. You've got the Mercedes vote. Are we expecting a victory like this size? Have you talked to any people in Alabama? What are the thoughts so far?
I'd never want to get into predictions about that, but all I can say from, you know, talking to members, you had union workers from Detroit after their big wins coming down and talking with workers down in Chattanooga, encouraging them, saying like, if we did it up here, you can do it down here. The same thing's happening. Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga are looking to Mercedes and saying, hey, if we did it here, you can do it there. And they've been tirelessly organizing. I think the UAW has a really good strategy with the stand-up strikes that we're seeing. They're smart about how they use their resources. And I'm excited to see what happens in these other plants. And, you know, any time that workers are talking to each other and spreading inspiration that way, I think it's a good thing. So we'll see where it goes.
I'm right there with you. And look, I would love to see a master contract at some point in my lifetime where all auto workers are making the same wages, hours, conditions, so that, you know, it's who makes the best widget and not who's working for the cheapest wages.
Yep. Speak it into existence.
There you go. John, I appreciate the time. Excellent reporting over at More Perfect Union. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out so people can take a look at the video that's gotten over 2.5 million views so far. But John Russell, thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
John Russell, owner and editor of The Holler newsletter. Make sure you check out the work that they do at theholler.co. We'll get links out on social media. Now you can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Quick break. Right back.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A few showers around during the overnight, mostly cloudy skies and breezy, lows near the 50-degree mark. More showers and thunderstorms will be possible on Tuesday, a mix of clouds and sunshine. Breezy winds, highs in the upper 60s. Right now, it's 55.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Letting someone else live their life in a way that you may not agree with, guess what? That's American. That's what we get to do here. We don't get to place our religious beliefs in a position of governmental endorsement so that we can exclude others from our educational systems, from our boardrooms. That ain't American. It isn't the Wisconsin that I know either.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So Monday on the program, you heard us talk about how with just a stroke of a pen, the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, or as some are calling him, Ron Death Santis, wiped away the ability for local governments there in Florida from requiring, I don't know, heat protection for workers, protecting people on the job, make sure they don't die from heat-related injuries. DeSantis, no, we're going to make heat stroke great again. And that's why I've asked our good friend Jordan Barab to come talk with us, former OSHA deputy secretary under the Obama administration, my go-to guy, everything safety, health and safety. Make sure you check out his Confined Spaces blog. We'll get links out on social media. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Happy to be here, Rick.
So what happened? I talked about this on Monday. Death Santis, as they're now calling him, decided, hey, we're gonna make heatstroke great again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's no secret that it gets hot in Florida, and in fact, Florida is probably the hottest state in the country. The number of heat-related deaths are going up there. The number of days with extreme heat in the summer are rising rapidly. You know, last year was the hottest year on the record in the world, and also in the United States, and also in Florida. So needless to say, you know, Florida's got a big agriculture industry, a big construction industry, a lot of workers working outside, exposed to extreme heat. And some of the localities in Florida thought, you know, maybe we should do something about this. I mean, federal OSHA doesn't have a heat standard yet. They can do some citing under their general duty clause, but that's difficult. So Miami-Dade County commissioners got together last year and decided to put together a local ordinance that would require employers to provide provide shade, rest, and water to outdoor workers in the agriculture construction industry. And the business community went berserk. They were, you know, spreading fears of massive job loss and economic dislocation, destruction of the, you know, the Florida agriculture industry. And so the county council backed off. But that wasn't good enough for DeSantis and the Republican legislature. They passed a law, and DeSantis just signed it last week, that prohibited any locality in Florida from passing any kind of ordinance or regulation that was more strict than the state has to protect workers against heat. And of course, the state doesn't have anything to protect workers against heat. So basically, Miami-Dade and any other locality in Florida is now unable to, in fact, prohibited from passing any kind of ordinance that would force employers to protect workers against heat on the job.
I don't know where you go with that. I mean, you know, there's so much here. Let's start with the smaller, less intrusive government, thing, a local government argument. Let's start with that. Isn't this a local government thing? Shouldn't this be what, the DeSantis's of the world, what conservatives of the world be going, look, your local communities, not the big state or not the federal government, should be setting these things. Am I missing something here?
Well, yeah, I mean, they believe in states' rights, of course, especially when there's a Democratic president, then the state should be able to do whatever they want. But that doesn't translate down to local rights, city rights, or Miami-Dade to protect its hundreds of thousands of outdoor workers. Then he wants to be the dictator and the big government guy who's going to tell everybody what they have to do.
And then the other part of it is, you hit on it a second ago, the industry started losing their mind. Oh, this is, job-killing regulations, job-killing. This is literally a situation of people killing lack of regulation. There are people who are dying from heat-related illnesses, so much so that, as you pointed out, in Miami-Dade, they wanted to actually do something, which is quite remarkable. So I guess the first person who dies from this, does their family get to go back and sue DeSantis and the Republicans for this? I mean, at some point, don't they have to?
One would hope, yeah. I mean, or that there'd be some kind of political awakening in Florida and throw the guy out and throw out the Republicans in the legislature. I mean, this is a really bad bill. I mean, they have this whole piece of legislation. There's not one word in there that actually recognizes that heat is a hazard. It doesn't, usually there's a preamble saying, X number of workers die and get sick and it's a hazard. Nothing in there that even admits or recognizes that there's even a hazard to deal with. They're just totally into, making sure that employers get their way in every shape and form. He didn't just sign this about heat. I mean, that's bad enough because it's killing people.
Right.
But, the laws that he signed also prohibit localities from raising the minimum wage among the state wage or putting any kind of requirements, wage and hour or any kind of requirements on employers that get local contracts. So basically, again, they're saying, the state has priority and everybody else is prohibited from doing anything to treat their workers better than the state decides to treat them.
Now, this is the mother of preemption bills. And look, a major power grab by the state. And this, again, I come back to, and this is why I find it so interesting that it's DeSantis and Republicans who are doing this, because they're supposed to be the ones who are, government's bad, we should do things local. I guess I'm fixated on that.
Yeah, well, hypocrisy has never been a a good excuse not to do something, especially for Republicans.
Yeah. No, good point. And as I say, look, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at this. This is literally going to kill somebody. And I'm not being hyperbolic. We know that's going to happen, don't we?
No, we absolutely do know that. I mean, OSHA, OSHA can cite under what's known as its general duty clause. When it doesn't have, it doesn't have standards, it can use the general duty clause. It's difficult, it's burdensome, and it gets overthrown in court a lot. But just today, OSHA announced a citation in Florida against a company, an agricultural company, whose employee died his first day on the job from heat-related illness. So obviously it's a problem there. I mean, this was last summer. Now we're just getting into this summer. And, this bill becomes effective? July 1st, the height of the summer. They're going to tell everybody that they don't get any heat protections.
I don't know do we hold the moment of silence now so that I can figure out, how to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, you just got to keep drumming on them. You got to keep drumming on them, especially the worker advocates in Florida.
Jordan, this is where I go, okay, well, if the states abdicate their responsibility to protect workers, isn't this where Biden and the federal government should be stepping in and saying, look, if you're going to refuse to do anything to protect people, this is where we have to?
Well, they are. I mean, OSHA is working on a heat standard, but OSHA takes a long time. It takes years and years sometimes decades to issue standards. I mean, that's just the way it works for a variety of reasons. So OSHA is working on a standard. They're trying to accelerate it. But I mean, it's obviously not going to happen this administration. And if, you know, if there's a second Trump administration, it will never happen. Even, you know, even a second Biden administration, they'll struggle to get it out by the end because it takes so long. So it's not something that Biden doesn't recognize or that OSHA doesn't recognize. It just takes them a long time. And that's why in the meantime, there are states and localities that are deciding they don't want to wait on OSHA. They can act faster and they're acting. And then you have states like Texas, which passed a similar law to the one we're talking about now, and Florida, who are going in the exact opposite direction.
So why does it take so long? I mean, look, I know you were, you know, you're the former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA. You were there. Why does this take so long?
Yeah, that was the most frustrating thing about that job, is that it takes so long to get OSHA regulations out. I mean, part of it is the hurdles that are kind of built into the act. You know, OSHA has to prove there's a significant risk. They have to prove that it's economically and technologically feasible in every possible industry that it'll affect. Congress has passed additional laws making it harder to get regulations out. The White House, you know, in Republican and Democratic administrations have passed executive orders that slow down the process. And that on top of the fact that OSHA has a tiny, tiny budget, about, you know, $500 million compared to, I think it's $10 billion now for EPA. And they just don't have very many staff to actually issue these regulations.
I guess
Trump,
in
fact, cut OSHA's regulatory budget by 10%. And only last year did it finally catch up to where it was before the Trump administration. And now, because of, you know, the deals, the budget deals on the Hill, you know, you basically got flat budgets, which means budget cuts, you know, with inflation. So, you know, OSHA's, you know, hamstrung, you know, everywhere you look. And basically, you know, the regulatory process is broken over at OSHA.
I guess it shows what we think of working people. Honestly, yeah. when you put it the way you do. But this one seems simple to me. And maybe it's just that I'm someone who's worked in really hot environments. And our union has always gone to bat for our workers. And this, again, another reason I believe all working people should join and form unions, so that you have the ability to deal with these issues on the job. But, you know, when temperatures get above 95 degrees, you know, every hour you get, you know, 5 minutes to cool down and get a drink. I don't know that that's so difficult to come up with. Pick a temperature where scientists are saying, hey, this is where the body starts to break down. Let's get a water break. Let's cool down. And it's not going to kill productivity.
No.
This is not,
you know, rocket science, as I say. It's not difficult. We know what to do. We know how to prevent heat-related illness. It's just a matter of doing it. You know, remember Deepwater Horizon, you had thousands of workers cleaning up the beaches there, and they had imported all these workers from New Orleans, and a lot of them were in really bad shape. They're wearing Tyvek suits. And we looked at that and we said, holy shit, you know, a lot of these guys are going to die and end up in the hospital. So we, you know, worked out a deal with, BP and with the Coast Guard, that they would basically, do what we said. And we had workers that were, you know, they were working like 20 minutes an hour. You know, they'd work for 10 minutes, take, you know, 20 minutes off, work for another 10 minutes, take 20 minutes off. We had a lot of complaints from the governor saying, you know, I used to mow lawns, you know, when I was a kid in the hot weather.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fact was, not one worker got sent to the hospital. We didn't lose anybody because of that. So, again, we know what to do. It's just a matter of the political will to do it.
Yeah, no, I've been in those suits. It's not doing anything in those suits is not just any other day. I've done the whole SCBA, you know, with the mask and the self-contained, all of that. And
yeah,
it's not good, especially on the hot days. And again, in my workplace, where we had a union, we negotiated how long you could be in and how long you had to be out. These were problems we could solve locally. But sadly, again, what's happened over the last 50 years is of late, labor has been under attack, and the ability to solve these problems locally, unfortunately, has been diminished, which is why we need states with strong regulations to protect workers, why we need a federal government with strong regulations to protect workers' health. I just don't know any other way.
No, exactly. And you know, what's particularly insulting and you know, just displays how little understanding these guys have over what goes on in a workplace was, if you read the preamble to the law, it says that one of the major problems with ordinances like Miami-Dade was considering was that they, and this is a quote, ignore the individual responsibility of an employee to follow relevant guidance and to protect him or herself from heat-related illness. right? I mean, they're basically blaming the worker for their own illnesses. They're putting all the burden on workers to be able to somehow just have the agency to go take a drink of water anytime they want, or rest anytime they want, or find a shady area anytime they want, which obviously workers, especially non-union, low-paid, vulnerable workers, aren't going to ever be able to do. I mean, it's just insulting, and just shows how little understanding they have. And even, I mean, to add to that, I mean, this law they have doesn't just prohibit employers from being required to provide water and shade. It prohibits employers from being required to even provide training or even putting up signs that warn about heat. So, I mean, on one hand, you're saying workers need to have agency and take responsibility for their own health and safety, and figure out, you know, how to protect themselves, assuming they have the ability to do that. On the other hand, their employers aren't even required to educate workers about, you know, what they have to do to protect themselves. I mean, it's just absurd. And it's, you know, again, as you say, workers are going to die, and the blood is on the hands of the Florida legislature and the governor.
So you said something that, you know, again, grabbed my attention, because basically this language of blaming the victim, of blaming the worker for their injury. This takes me back to, you know, I studied labor history. This goes back to pre workers' comp days, where, you know, yeah, they would go into court and, well, you know, the worker slipped and fell into the vat of steel. You know, granted there were no, you know, gates up. There was no protection for them. Granted, there were, you know, no covers or anything. You know, he tripped. It was his fault. He shouldn't have tripped. This harkens to that. And so there's part of me that asks, you know, and I know you can't answer this, but there's part of me that asks the question of, was that put there specifically to begin that kind of process of not just heat-related injuries, but all injuries being able to be blamed on the individual?
Exactly. As you indicated, I mean, over 100 years ago, before there was workers' comp, you know, employers, you know, would blame workers. I mean, they're too lazy, you know, they're careless, you know, they're just, you know, killing themselves. And the whole point of workers' comp was to be, you know, basically blameless. You know, it was, you know, you got hurt, you got compensated. That was it. And then OSHA finally came in and put the actual responsibility on employers, not on workers, but on employers who control the work site, to ensure that their workplaces are safe. Yeah. And this just goes totally in the opposite direction of that.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me that we're in this moment. And I guess it's, look, this is 50 years of a right-wing attack on organized labor, on educating workers, and I'm not surprised by it. And look, you know, you look at states like my state of Pennsylvania, and there are attacks on workers' comp laws, there are attacks on right to organize laws. I'm hoping we wake up pretty soon.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's an election year, right? I mean, this should be an issue that people are voting on.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping you're right. Jordan, I appreciate the time. Hope folks will check out the website, jordanbarab.com/confined space. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at the great work he does. Jordan, thanks so much.
All right, you're welcome, Rick. Happy to be here.
Appreciate the time. Jordan Barab, former acting assistant secretary and deputy assistant secretary of labor for OSHA. I want to hear your thoughts. What's it like in your workplace? Are there heat standards in your neck of the woods? Or is this left up to the benevolent employer? If he thinks it's hot enough for you to get a drink of water, and can you leave your workspace whenever you want? I want to hear it. Rick at the ricksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was a day of tragedy for workers in the gold fields of Serbia. Gold miners by the Lena River in southeast Serbia worked under brutal conditions. The Lena Gold Mining Joint Stock Company ran the mining operation. The lucrative gold mines lined the pockets of shareholders, including Russian aristocrats and British industrialists. But the workers saw very little of the bounty they mined. They toiled for 16 hours a day for low wages. To make matters worse, workers were often paid in coupons they could cash in for food at the company store. The quality of the food was poor. A staggering 700 accidents occurred for every 1,000 workers in the mines. At the end of February, when one group of workers was given rancid meat, they had finally had enough. The workers walked out on strike. Soon they were joined by thousands of their comrades. They formed a strike committee and demanded an 8-hour day, 30% wage increase, better food, and improved workplace conditions. At first, the company agreed to talk to the workers, but negotiations went nowhere. Troops were called in and arrested the entire strike committee. Workers rallied to demand the release of their leaders. A crowd of 2,500 striking workers gathered. The troops fired into the unarmed crowd, wounding an estimated 500 workers and killing more than 250. As outraged workers across the country learned of the massacre, a wave of workers' strikes and protests swept throughout Russia. On May Day, 300,000 workers marched in the streets for the eight-hour day. The gold miners continued their strike throughout the summer, but to no avail. Thousands eventually left the gold fields to find less brutal work elsewhere.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So it's interesting talking with Jordan about this, the fact that we don't really have strong regulations in place. We don't. And it's about time that we do. And look, you know, when DeSantis does this, people are going to die. That's the reality. We know that's going to happen. In fact, last September, you had a 26-year-old man go from Mexico to South Florida. He was here on a work visa, an H-2A work visa, temporary seasonal non-immigrant worker visa. Because, look, we need people to pick the crops, and in Florida especially. So he went there to get some work. Needs to feed his family. A hot day, 97 degrees, heat index high. This 26-year-old guy's 4 days. He's on the job. 4 days, he's here from Mexico. He suffers a fatal heat-related injury, dies. Where he was, 20 minutes from the closest road, 22 miles from the nearest hospital where he was transported and later died because of heat stroke. And again, these are things that can be mitigated. In fact, you know, one of the things they talked about in the press release is, you know, this guy's only been in the country 4 days. Different heat probably from where he's from to Florida. Florida, hot. Just allowing the guy to get acclimated to the weather conditions. I know myself, you know, the change of season, it takes a little time to get used to it being really cold or really hot. And these employers, they don't care. I mean, this is the part, you know, where we as Americans, we as, me as a union guy, many people who work in offices and don't really think about how desperate a lot of working people are. This idea that, oh, we could just go take a break whenever you want. Have some personal responsibility. No, that's not how it works in a lot of these places. You work or you don't get to come back. You work or they turn you in. You work or bad things happen. So, you know, I look at this and I'm going, you know, it's horrible that this guy, 26 years old, healthy guy, dead. If that's not bad enough, the company responsible for this, and look, the OSHA, you know, found them responsible. There are things they could have and should have done to ensure that people had water breaks, rest shade areas, that kind of stuff to ensure that they don't. Maybe someone watching over to make sure that, hey, you're not sweating. That's bad. The worst part of it is the McNeil Labor Management Group. They face a whopping fine. An almost unpayable fine of $27,655. That's the amount set by federal statute. So this guy's life is worth $27,655, which, you know, not surprising. I thought it was going to be lower. Now the reality is that this could have been prevented. And, oh, shocker of all shockers, the company, they're fighting it. Because, of course, they are. So the question I have is, when do we as working people say enough is enough? And, or is it this, well, he's just a temporary seasonal migrant worker. We don't really care about them. You know, remember that thing that, that Labor sang in the old days, an injury to one, injury to all? If you allow it to happen to him, eventually it's going to happen to you. Maybe we protect people with sane, rational, reasonable regulation. I don't think it's unreasonable to get an extra couple minutes to get a drink or sit in the shade when you stop sweating. Seems kind of smart. Also, some good news. The Biden administration on Tuesday, they have agreed to some new silica dust standards. They are going to limit the exposure of silica dust, a toxic dust. One of the things that kills people. Because understand, you know, what we're seeing right now is not grandpa's black lung. No. In fact, what we're seeing is younger people getting sicker because of the technological advancements. We are now using much better drilling technology, which means we're cutting into more layers of rock that contain silica just to get to the real fine, you know, the thin seams of coal. Because we're scraping the bottom of the barrel right now. We got to get every bit of it. And what does that mean? Well, that means you've got young people developing severe respiratory issues. You know, black lung is one of those things that everyone knows about. It's what miners get because they go down into the ground and the dust and the coal dust, the silica, all this stuff. You end up getting not just black lung, but you get progressive massive fibrosis, lung cancer, chronic bronchitis, kidney diseases. There's so much here. So the Biden administration has issued some new guidelines. They are reducing the allowable silica dust levels to 50 micrograms per cubic meter. And what does that mean? It means it's a much smaller amount than it used to be. And with an action level of 25 micrograms for an 8-hour workday, what they're saying is we got to figure out how we, I don't know, have people getting sick and dying, especially as the numbers of people who are in the mining industry are going down. The number of people who are getting sick seems, as a percentage of the people who are doing the job, seem to be going up. And as I said, coal miners make up, you know, a minor number of our miners. About 55,000 people nationwide are in the coal mining industry. You compare that with people who are mining metals and non-metal and stone and sand, gravel, all that stuff, with about 200,000. This respiratory rule helps them as well. It also updates respiratory protection standards, which means, you know, maybe, I don't know, having a mask. In addition to this silica dust standard, the rule also applies to diesel particle matter and asbestos. That is a good thing. So the coal dust for coal miners, it'll be a year from Thursday. Other mine operators, it'll be 2026 when the standard goes into place. Good stuff. I mean, and well overdue. Something that should have been done years ago. Again, getting things done. Common sense. Why it's taken so long, I don't know. But good on Joe Biden and the administration. And finally, Chris from Oakland sent me an email, you know, with the subject line of "Which side are you on?" He says, "Rick, at the end of your show, you closed with that question." He says, "As a veteran, as the father of two veterans, one combat vet, as an American, my answer is in the attached meme. Thank you for your voice. See you at the polls." And the meme was the United States of America or the Republican Party. In 2025, only one of these is likely to still exist as we know it today. It's time to pick a side. And he says, "I'm betting on the USA," and I am as well, Chris. Thanks so much for the email. And look, you know, this again, like a lot of things, it's a "which side are you on" type of scenario. Are you on the side of workers and safety? Are you on the side of corporations and profit? Or are you on the side of workers and safety? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. As always, if you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast for your audio pleasure. Also, freespeech.org is where you find the video. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.